written by Moses, roughly about 1500 BC. There are older books, of course, than your book of Genesis. Usually in most semesters, when the semesters begin at college, I usually get a couple calls by our freshman college kids who've moved from our youth group into our into their college. And usually there's a professor or three or six or 12 that are going to try to shred their faith. And one of the things they love to bring up is, did you know that the flood story of Noah predates Moses and Moses copied it from? And then they will introduce, I don't know, the plates of Gilgamesh or whoever knows what it might be. Don't be shocked that there are older historians documenting various things than Moses. But remember, Moses heard it from his mom. His mom heard it from her, what is it, grandfather, Jacob, who lived and he knew Shem, who was Noah's son, because Shem lived 500 years after the flood. And Shem's grandfather, Lamech, knew Adam personally. That's how long they lived. And then don't forget also that the Lord called Moses up to Mount Sinai for 40 days and then another 40 days. So whatever he didn't have right from his mom, who had been really, what, four-ish generations from an eyewitness, God, of course, could fill him in. So God tells Moses specifically how it all went down. And are you ready? As I said, we'll only get to maybe chapter, verse number 5. But there's lots here. Chapter 1, Genesis, verse 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Verse 2, and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep. Some people believe that between verse 1, when everything evidently was okay, heavens and the earth, and verse 2, and is it suddenly that the earth is without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep? Some people believe that this is the result of when Lucifer falls and takes a third of the angels with him, and evidently some sort of battle ensues that might have wrecked and ravaged God's perfect creation. It's called the gap theory, between verses 1 and 2. I don't hold to that, and I'll show you why here in a minute, but wanted to let you know that for some people, to them it makes apparent sense. So, one more time, God created the heavens and the earth, verse 2. What happened? Now we see the earth was without form and void, and there was darkness over the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering, interesting Hebrew word, rokaph, and it means to grow soft and to relax. God relaxed over this current circumstance and situation. He relaxed over the face of the waters. What gets a little confusing is we're going to see a couple different separations of water. The first separation of water, we won't get to it tonight, is the separation of water below from the water above. And then we will see the separations laterally of the continents and the oceans. So here is the face of the waters, and now we're going to get more specific. By the way, rabbis teach that this day we've just read is Tishri, the month of Tishri 1, or in the fall of our fall season. So they call it, as it were, the creation, the birthday of creation itself. Then you might remember in Exodus 12, when Moses is leading the people out, the Jewish people out of Egypt, God says, now this month, Nisan, I want you to change it to become the first month. And currently, that's what can be so confusing, because the Jews still observe two calendars concurrently. Tishri, Rosh Hashanah, is the first of the year in our fall, if you will. That is the civil calendar. But then also they observe Nisan 1 as the beginning of the ceremonial calendar. So it can get kind of crazy. Tishri 1 is in the fall. That's why you see Rosh Hashanah, the beginning of the head of the year in the fall in Jewish society. But then you'll also have a celebration in the spring which is the month of Nisan. And that's when the seven feasts of Moses will begin. Is there a gap between verses 1 and 2, the battle between God and the fallen angels, which wrecked everything, hence without form and void? I don't think so. If the fall of Satan or the battle that ravaged creation did happen here, then the following 6 days that we're going to look at, wouldn't that then be the second creation? The idea being, God made everything, it was wrecked, and now he's building it over. I don't think that is a logical flow. And also, too, remember in Revelation 21, verse 1, the first heaven and the first earth passed away. Well, then, when did Satan fall? If you want to, you can write in your margin, Job 38, verses 4 through 7. Let's turn there. I'm going to show you. I believe that this is when it happens, or somewhere close to it. Grab the book of Job, if you would. Book of Job, right before Psalms, and look at Job chapter 38. And the Lord is encouraging Job, of course. Job is pretty sure he has all the facts, and all the facts are terrible. And the Lord shows up through this gentleman, and he says, really? Where were you when this happened and that happened? Hey, I'm doing the driving, Job. You got to trust me. Now, what's this little sort of detail? You in chapter 38 of Job? Look down to verse 4. Job 38, verse 4. Where were you when I, the Lord, laid the foundations of the earth? Yeah, I wasn't around then. Well, I was. Tell me if you have understanding. Verse 5. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. If you're ever feeling like it's too much and overwhelming, God gets it. But he's trying to remind Job and perhaps even us, we don't have all the facts. Surely you know, right, Job? Or who stretched the line upon it? Verse 6. To what were its foundations fastened? Or who laid its cornerstone? Verse 7. When the morning stars, you can circle that, those are angels. When the morning stars sang together, comma, and all, circle all, the sons of God, angels, shouted for joy. I believe that this is telling us that by the time God finishes day 6 of creation, none of the angels had fallen yet at that time. I believe God is telling Job, when I got done with the 6 days of creation, how many of the sons of God rejoiced and shouted for joy? All of them. I believe that sometime after Adam and Eve were cruising in the garden, all put together, that that's when the fall happened. I also have a notion, I can't prove it, of course, doctrinally, but I have a notion that for some length of time, before they ate of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, that they communed with God in the cool of the day. I don't believe it's a stretch to maybe consider that maybe they walked with angels too. I don't know that to be sure, but I wonder. And remember, they had no ability to even conceptualize sin. And so later, when the serpent, remember, that's not the Hebrew word for a reptile, the word there is nakosh, a shining one. Lucifer means lucence. Why wasn't Eve freaked out about a talking snake? I don't believe it was a snake, number one. And number two, I believe that she knew Lucifer. Anyway, so there you go, Job chapter 38. I don't think there is a gap between verse 1 and verse 2. Back to Genesis chapter 1. We're now in verse number 3. Then God said, let there be light, and there was light. What kind of light is God talking about? Light like this? Incandescence? Come to find out, light itself was a real mystery for humans for a very long time. But before we get into the physics and the science, I would like you to notice, please, what are the very first recorded words of God speaking? Let there be light. God's first recorded words to absolutely nothing. nothing. It was formless and void, complete darkness. Let there be light. And I've got a little mark in my margin here. If God could speak into the nothing that was nothing, and with a word, eventually he's going to make the entire universe. Can God look into something that I perceive as being empty and void and speak life there too? I believe so. And I put together a list here. Are you ready? Rick, we're going to go over this. A quick little breakdown. Now, when God said, let there be light, I don't believe it's this kind of light that we're seeing now. Come to find out that this kind of light has some physics principles to it. And by the way, I think that the light that we're talking about here in verse 3 is the Shekinah glory of God. Well, let me show you what I'm talking about here. Go ahead, Rick, with our first one. Black, and then God said, light be, bang, light was. I believe, and you've heard me say it before, in the multidimensional place where God lives, who has all energy, all and every frequency of power. There's no distance, there's no such thing as many or few. I believe there is so much energy that when he does this, he's going to slow some of that infinite energy down into what I believe is going to be the molecules and ultimately the building blocks of everything that you and I see today. So it could be this. Go ahead, Rick, if you would. Zing. That is basically an atom, and you see it's got a nucleus with a proton and a neutron clustered together and flying around on the outside are electrons. The scale of this is truly off because they're so small that the electrons would be actually quite a ways further out, but they are nonetheless flying around in an orbit of sorts, but they're flying at such a velocity that it would appear there's an energy shell, if you will, and depending on what element you're talking about, how many electrons are there, the more electrons, the more levels, and more shells, if you were. I've featured here something called a photon flying out. What is a photon? The real answer is I can't really explain it other than it is really small and it leaps into its being when there is energy enough applied to an atom, energy in the form of heat. And when those electrons get flying around, they get so energetic that they leap from one sort of orbit to another. And when they do, they give off a sub-subatomic particle called a photon. And that's what you and I see as light. You got to understand something. That was a real head-scratcher for a very, very, very long time. Now, it could be this kind of light. I'm going to explain it more in a minute. But I don't think so. I think it was, go ahead, Rick, this kind of light. I think it was the Shekinah. I really do. Those photons, by the way, they travel at about 186,000 miles per second, as you know. But the Shekinah glory doesn't necessarily have a travel time. I think it is everywhere present. And then whenever God wants to show the humans, I believe he opens up a part of our four-dimensional time space. And a little bit of his multidimensional universe peeks through. It's only a theory of mine, but I think that's something close to that. Because to the humans, it looks like a pillar of fire. But remember, the Shekinah glory shows up in a couple different locations. Acts chapter 2, a little bit of cloven tongues of fire. I believe that that was a bit of the Shekinah glory. When Jesus comes out of his baptism, what lands on him? It was something that appeared in the form of a dove. I believe that that was a portion of the Shekinah glory. And remember, they hear a voice when Jesus comes out of his baptism. This is my son in whom I am well pleased. I believe that it came through that little manifestation, that opening into another multidimensional universe through which God speaks. But for your consideration, I believe that the light talked about here is the Shekinah glory. Hint, this is the light that illuminates the New Jerusalem. Remember in Revelation 22, verse 5, there is no sun. But then John tells us, or the angel showing John around said, you don't need the sun because there's light everywhere and there is no night time. I believe that is the light. Later, God is going to make the sun and a number of stars. And I believe that that is the more combustive portion of what we're looking at. So that's your day one. And now day two, just so that we can kind of get a look at it. Go ahead, Rick. Day two, the Bible is going to call the firmament. Now, most people teach that the firmament is the land, and it could be, between the heavens, the water above and the water below, and it very well could be. But I think that here in the last probably 100 years, especially with advances in machinery, able to generate energy fields and such and interactions, we've been slamming these elements together in these large hadron colliders, and we've been able to identify a bunch of the elements. I personally think that the firmament itself is basically matter. Go. I believe it's also this. These are your four forces in the universe, if you didn't know. All the forces that you and I deal with here in our three-dimensional system, well, four if you count time, linear time, are these. Strong force. The strong force keeps the protons and the neutrons together in the nucleus. The weak force is the radiation that kicks out subatomic particles out of that nucleus. You have electromagnetism, which is you can mess with these electrons. You can fire them down a copper wire. You can use them to power electric motors and computers and all that kind of stuff. It's very handy. And there are certain rules that we have learned over the years about electromagnetism. Now, at the bottom is another force that's very much a mystery. It is so much weaker in the sense of initially we can do radioactivity that is very strong, even harmful, strong force and electromagnetism at great forces. Gravity is bizarre. It is very, very, very bizarre. And Einstein was trying to figure out there's something very peculiar. The latest sort of understanding about gravity itself, funny thing about gravity, it doesn't travel. Light takes, 93 million miles away. It takes several minutes for light to leave the sun's surface, and then we see it here on planet Earth. Gravity is acting upon Earth and the sun at the same time. Pluto is being pulled by the gravity of the sun at the same time. There's something interesting about gravity, and more we study it, we have a notion that gravity is a field, and it has little particles, like electronic field, there's electrons, etc. And there's an idea that the gravity itself may be little particles behaving in quantum mechanics, and they've called them gravitons. I don't know, we'll see. But the Large Hadron Collider has opened up the door. We believe the gravity has a force, and it comes from outside our four dimensions. Anyway, so there's those. And I wanted to show you this else. Look at this. Go. And then everything else that the firmament is, these are very important constants and physics principles. Planck's constant, Faraday's constant, Boltzmann's constant, fine structure. Look at those hairy old sort of equations. If any of these are slightly different, no life could happen on Earth. There's more. I got another page, Rick. Go ahead. Here's another one. Magnetic constant, electric constant, Coulomb, etc., etc. All the way down to the bottom, Bohr's radius, molar volume. I don't know what a lot of these do, but there are scientists who do. And if you take physics to any degree, you find out what all these do. Here's what I want to bring your attention to. There's something called an anthrocentric idea, anthros, mankind. There's an interesting understanding that if any of these change just a little bit, if the Bohr radius mathematics was just a little bit one way or the other, then all of the rest of these don't work. Let me show you what else I'm talking about. Go ahead. Here, of course, is our solar system. It's not to scale, of course, but you get an idea that the sun is in the center and the planets rotate around. How many of you would like a winter condo on Mercury? Probably not, because the average temperature is over 1,000 degrees. And you don't want to go too far away. We can't live on Uranus, and we can't live on Neptune, which is mostly gas. We can't live on Saturn, and we can't live on Jupiter. If we lived on Jupiter, which is largely gas on the outside, the gravity is so much, we would land on it, and then our own body weight would crush all of our organs. There's too much gravity. It seems that there's a Goldilocks zone that the Earth just happens to be in. If we were any closer, there would be no life on the Earth. If we were any farther away, there would be no life on the Earth. There's a whole understanding, and it's very important, that all of that physics I just showed you, and chemistry here in a second that I'm going to show you, when you look at it, and if you get into that discipline more and more, if any of that is slightly different, there is no life on this planet. Do you think that that is by happenstance? I don't think so. There's many, many others of this anthropocentric understanding. If it were to change a little bit one way or the other, there wouldn't be life, but I won't bore you to tears. Let's go ahead and go to our next one. I think this is also part of the firmament. This is chemistry. It's a beautiful chart, as you can see. And if you've had chemistry, you know a lot more what you're looking at than I am. And then you'll notice that the elements themselves, depending on how many protons, neutrons, electrons, become this different element. Then there toward the bottom, those are man-made elements, because we have atom smashers, and we have nuclear reactors, et cetera, et cetera. But the point of that, if these were altered just in the slightest, there would be no life left on Earth. And then, of course, I believe this is part of the firmament as well. Go ahead. Linear time, past, present, and future, did not exist before Genesis 1, verse 1. And you've heard me over the years go over it. It's really something. You can mess with time. It runs faster. It runs slower, depending on gravity and velocity. I believe where God lives, there is no linear time. I believe that from his perspective outside of linear time, to us, we're on the timeline, past, present, and future. To us, we're stuck. But God is outside of it, and he can watch linear time, much like you would watch a parade from a helicopter. That's why he knows everything, because he can visit as much and stay as long as he wants, any nanosecond of time, because to him, he just pops out of it, pops back into it. And I believe that that's why we see pre-incarnate appearances of Jesus, the resurrected Jesus, in the Old Testament. When he rose from the dead, he hung out with the disciples for 40 days. And then what happens when he walked out there on that Mount of Olives? What happens? He went right out of sight. Well, where'd he go? Psalm 104 says, right to the right hand of the Father. And I believe that the resurrected Jesus can pop in and out of the timeline whenever he wants. All right, well, anyway, that's day two, the firmament. Go ahead, Rick. Now we're going to get to day three. This is Tuesday. Sunday, if you will, was day one. Monday is day two. Tuesday is day three. What happens there? We get land and plant life. Did you know that life itself is a mystery to humans? Well, what do you mean? Well, our scientists, and there have been those over the years that have said, well, we can make life. And you need to understand, well, no, they can't. Humans cannot make life. Let me show you what they're talking about when scientists say, well, we can build stuff too. Go ahead, Rick. You might get a kick out of this. Well, what is this? In 1952, in University of Chicago, that's Dr. Stanley Miller and Dr. Harold Urey, they simulate the likely chemical conditions of the early Earth. How would they know that? But they took a guess. And they demonstrated that a complex organic molecule, specifically amino acids, could be synthesized from simple organic precursors. In other words, let's take and imagine what primordial earth looked like soon after it cooled into a crust on the earth. Well, where did life come from? Well, it came from building blocks that we know today as amino acids. And amino acids build molecules of proteins, and they do a number of wonderful things in your body. So they said, huh, what if we came up with an experiment and try to replicate the process? Well, what did they do? Well, they built a closed glass apparatus to mimic the primitive atmosphere and water cycle. How would they know what that would be? Well, they took a guess. They filled a flask with water, vapor, and methane, and ammonia, and hydrogen. And then they provided an energy source in the form of a tungsten, two tungsten electrodes, zap, zap, to create continuous electrical sparks simulating lightning. In other words, that's what they figured was an energy catalyst that got these amino acids moving. Because remember, the amino acids are going to eventually form molecules, and molecules are going to eventually form cells, and cells are going to make come together and make simple, and then to vertebrates, and finally to mammals and humans. They have a long way to go. But back to this experiment. One flask contained boiling water to create water vapor, mimicking the ocean and evaporation, while a condenser turned the vapor back into liquid, mimicking rain. The result? After 1 week of operation, the water turned deep red and turbid. Using paper chromatography, Miller identified 5 amino acids, including glycine and alanine. And they were to find out later they actually had created 20 amino acids, but had actually produced more. Living cells, by the way, we need 20 amino acids, different ones, in combinations. For instance, meat is a good protein source, but if you don't have meat, you go corn and beans. The corn and the beans together will combine for your necessary 20 amino acids to form the protein that you need. That's pretty cool, and cooks know all about this. So then they got done there in 1952, and they went, we did it. We created life in a flask. Whoa, whoa, whoa. You were able to combine a number of basic elements into amino acids. How far is it from amino acids to a functioning cell with hundreds of machines doing what machines do? A very large and long leap. Humans aren't even close to making life. God says, I know how to do it. Nowadays, did you know the humans can synthesize what are called nucleobases? We know them as adenine, guanine, cytosine, and thymine. Does that sound familiar? Hey, aren't those the 4 building blocks of DNA? There you go. We can make those in the laboratory. Hold on. How complex is DNA? Humans cannot turn these simple nucleobases into what we would probably describe as a 3/4 self-correcting digital code, a molecule so complex, that a DNA is a very different ball game. Your chromosomes, of course, if you would unwrap them and find these DNA molecules, maybe you didn't know, but for a refresher, if you were to uncoil a typical DNA molecule, it would be 6.5 feet long. That's a molecule. If you take those amino acids and make them the size of a BB, many people don't even know what BBs are anymore, Michael. Remember, we used to shoot BBs at each other? If you were to make your guanine, adenine, thymine, cytosine the size of a BB, then that molecule would be from this stage all the way to Carson City. That is a huge molecule. The molecule would stretch from here to Carson City. Well, anyway, I believe that that is what the firmament is about. What it actually looked like, we can only speculate. Was it land? Very well could be, because we're in day number 3 and we have plants growing, so it must be some sort of foundation, probably the surface of the earth. Now, I want you to notice that we're going to go to day 4. Go ahead, Ricky, if you would. Day number 4, what does God make? He makes the sun, the moon, the planets, and the stars. God's amazing timepiece for times and seasons is our sun and our moon. I started counting, and do you know how many moons there are with our several planets? Turns out there are, as of late, there are 891 moons. And that piggy Saturn has most of them. Saturn has 274 moons. Jupiter has 95. There's only one planet in this lineup, only one, that has a singular moon that is the specific right size at the right distance along the ecliptic. It is the only moon in this entire moon system that is the right size to completely eclipse our sun so that we can see the corona coming through the other side. Do you see that? No other planet and moon does it. Just ours. Does that sound odd to you? What would be the odds of that happening? I looked it up. It's literally 1 in 1 billion. Here's another way of saying, not by chance. That's the point. Also, I want to say this too. We'll talk more about evolution a bit later on, but basically when Darwin did his thing and he looked at the finches on the Galapagos Islands, and the Galapagos Islands are so far from any other mainland that the birds really can't do a lot of migrating, really one for the other. So on one island, he noticed that finches had very short, stout beaks, and that's important because on that island, Galapagos Island, there were seeds. That was the main food source. So they needed strong, crushing beaks, and so they survived. At another location, he saw the same finches, but their beaks were long and narrow and almost needle-like. The primary food source on that island was insects, and insects bore into things, and you need a needle-sharp sort of beak to get at them. So he went, wait a minute, we got beaks, short, stout, crushing beaks, and on the same finches and another island, we have needle-like beaks. Oh, look at that. There's changes. And that's what sparked his understanding of what you know today as evolution. Now, remember, it was a very different ballgame back then, and we didn't know about chromosomes. More on that in a minute. So what people try to do, because they have a sense that evolution, well, it's scientific, and creation is by faith, and so I get ridiculed at school. And so what some people have tried to do is they've tried to fit evolution, which at its basis assumes billions of years and random mutation. You just knock it out long enough, one of those generations is going to be more fit to survive than the next. And to be sure, environmental pressures do affect species, but pay close attention. Do we have big dogs, and then do we have little dogs? You've seen those? But they're still what? Dogs. We have big old horses and little tiny horses, but they're still horses. Breeding and generations can be affected by their environment to become more adapted to their environment. So Darwin was right when he made that assumption. But here's where his theory goes painfully awry. At the molecular level, the DNA level, you mess with that DNA chain, is it good or is it not good? And micromutations for a self-correcting digital code are rare. Darwin assumed that you could go from one species and make an entirely different species. Come to find out, that we cannot do. But back to our subject here. So some Christians, they try to say, well, maybe when God said a day, maybe it wasn't a 24-hour period. That's it. Maybe they come up with an idea called the day age. Maybe when God said day, maybe he meant millions of years. There you go. We can shoehorn in the evolutionary process, which doesn't work. But maybe if we tell people we believe in 6 days of creation, but they're not literal 24-hour days, they're epochs of time. I want you to notice something. Hit her up here if you would, Rick. When did God make the grasses? He made them on day 3. Hit the down arrow. Day 4, he makes the sun. I believe God, with a chuckle, said, I'm going to mix it up because I know there's going to be people that say, grasses were growing for millennia of time without a sun. I don't think so. Are you seeing that with me? Maybe the day age theory, maybe we can squeeze evolution into the book of Genesis. Answer, no, you can't. You cannot. Well, let's continue. That's day 4, which is the sun, moon, and the planets. Go now day 5. That's going to be Thursday. And day 5, we're going to see fish and fowl and even great sea creatures, each after its own kind. We would say species. The evolutionary column assumes very simple one-celled creatures in the bottom, and then as evolution does its thing, organic evolution, we're going to go molecules to man. And we don't see in the fossil records species, transitional species, new species. We don't see that. What we see in the fossil record is species and different species. And the Bible would say, yeah, because God made each species after its own kind. Now go ahead. In 1859, in his book, Origin of the Species, Darwin correctly noticed that there was an evolution or change of sorts. The environmental pressures did change the formation, it would seem, of beaks on the species of a finch within that species, remember. He didn't see a finch turning into a different species. And even today, as I said, do we have big dogs? Mm-hmm. Little dogs? Mm-hmm. Darwin didn't know about this 3/4 self-correcting digital code molecule. That if you unwrap it, it's 6.5 feet long. He looked under a microscope and he didn't see a cell with all of its many mechanisms. He saw blob. There's a blob. We know, however, that every cell is a marvel of hundreds of working little machines. And without one of those machines, highly complex, without them, if one of them goes a little nutty cuckoo, the entire cell doesn't work. At the basis of evolution is a DNA changes, thus affecting its cells, thus affecting all the little machines. You need to know that as a rule, that is not good for the organism. Well, anyway, let's go ahead. Let's go down to day number 6. Go. Now we're at Friday. Day 4 is a Wednesday. Day 5 is a Thursday. Day 6 is a Friday. And what do we have there? Hi, buddy. There's humans and animals. And go, amazing DNA. It took, did you know that when they wanted to map this molecule, it's only 4 real amino acids. Why is it, how is it so complex? When the humans had the instruments to see at that level and we wanted to map every one of those sequences, remember, if those guanine, adenine, thymine, and cytosine were the size of BBs, it would be a rope from here to Carson City. We want to take it apart and we want to map it. It was called the Human Genome Project. They started in the year 1990, and for 13 years, the fastest computers, 13 years, $2.7 billion, they got to about 97%. And the final gaps were not fully mapped until 2022. How amazing, how complex is the digital code of our DNA? Does it make logical sense to you that that level of complexity could come from randomness? One DNA strand contains more than 50 gigabytes of crucial information, and every single line of code is crucial for controlling a cell and its function. Does that kind of complexity come from randomness? I just don't think so. And does that sound like an unbelievably detailed design? Sure does to me. Ask Rick about coding and how difficult that can be. I think that that's designed, which would mean there would be a what? A designer. And then finally, day number 7, go ahead. Isn't that just peaceful? Don't want to climb into that. Oh, that's an awesome, beautiful place. That's day 7. That's Saturday. Rest. And I remember when I first encountered this, so God worked 6 days and he had to rest the 7th. Was he tired? Well, I thought God was all powerful. No, he rested because it is a pattern. Work 6, rest the 7th. And as I'm going to point out in our Sunday morning study, heptaphs or sevens are a huge part of God's design. Now verse 3. I told you we're only going to get to verse 5. So then God said, let there be light, and there was light. Let there be light. The first recorded words of God. His very nature, holy, pure, understanding. Light is all about bringing forth light from darkness. Now light itself is one of the most paradoxical mysteries known to science. Question, is light made up of waves? And the answer is, of course it is. That's why when you pick a triangle of a prism, you take white light, which is all of the colors, because colors are different frequencies, and then it bends and bends and bends into a rainbow. And that's why water droplets, when the sun is at a certain location, you can only see a rainbow if you are a certain degree, because the water droplets are acting as a prism. And that's why we see a rainbow, and that's why it's circular. And that's why you can never reach the end of it, because it's a reflection of the sun behind you, or at least on the other side. And that's why they say there's a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, because you can never get there. But in this idea, of course it's waves. Question. Well, if it's waves, waves are a pulse of energy coursing through a medium. Easy to see when you do it on water. You push the water, and the water energy, you see the wave. And by the way, it's a sine curve. You are hearing my voice because my larynx is flapping back and forth and pushing energy waves through the medium of air. In space, no one can hear you scream. Well, if there's oxygen in the spacecraft, of course they can. But if we are standing outside in a perfect vacuum, I speak to you, you can't hear me. The waves, there's nothing to propagate, no medium for that pulse of energy to go through. Question. If light from the sun is waves, how are the waves getting through the vacuum of space? Well, that was perplexing to the scientists as well. Is light waves? Well, don't they need a medium to traverse? How could light then travel through a vacuum of space? Well, then people said, well, then it must be particles. Now, in the vacuum of space, if I shoot a gun, a bullet will continue forever. I can shoot a particle through empty space, but particles don't behave like waves. So what is light? What is going on? Then there were this guy by the name, of course, Sir Isaac Newton. He had a couple ideas. And then you have a guy in the 1800s named Thomas Young, and he puts two slits together, fires light through it, and then it piles up in one sort of film, and then you have waves on the other. He's all, I have a radical idea. What if they are particles behaving in a wave fashion? Well, that might do something, but a lot of people didn't buy that. Then the popular notion called the ether came in, and that is there is a medium. There's not a vacuum in space. There is a medium, of course, but it's something we don't know yet, so they called it an ether. James Clerk Maxwell in 1839 to 1879, he worked out formulas explaining light's behavior through the ether. The idea that some kind of ether medium existed prevailed until 1887. Then a guy by the name of Albert Michelson in 1931 and Edward Morley utilized what's called an interferometer, which is basically mixing lights crossing each other's path, in an attempt to detect relative motion of the earth. No motion of the earth relative to the ether could be detected. Uh-oh, no ether. What's going on? It wasn't until 1905 when Albert Einstein figured it out. They are particles. They're behaving in a wave fashion. What kind of particles? So small that they are smaller than electrons. They are subatomic quantum particles, and somebody later called those photons. He wrote a paper on it, but he had to invent the math of what would become his theory of special relativity. That the velocity of light has the same value in all reference frames, whatever their velocity may be relative to other frames. Thus, modern physics took off in the direction of special and general relativity. The theory of quantum mechanics and the poor ether thing was tossed out. Until Professor Peter Higgs in 1965 says, I want to revisit the ether, not in the format that we were thinking of before, but he supposed there was a lattice work of quantum particles. You've heard me talk about that before. He postulated something called a boson, even smaller than a photon, and that there really is a fabric to all space and time. That, in fact, a vacuum of space is not empty at all. And, of course, they built the Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland to prove it. And in 2012, they found one. Back to us and our study, verse 4. So what is light? Lights are particles, those photons. You give something enough energy, it will leap its electron from one shell to the next, and a little photon gets fired off. That's combustion. You make a chemical process to some wood or some paper, and it burns. What you are seeing in the licking flames are photons that are short-lived. These lights above us are light-emitting diodes and how they invented those. And these lights shining on me specifically are incandescence. A filament is burning at such a temperature that's firing off photons. What are photons? They are subatomic quantum mechanic particles that are behaving like a wave. What I'm getting at is we are just now beginning to sort of take apart the firmament that God built with a word. Now verse 4. And God saw the light, that it was good, and God divided the light from the darkness. And God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. So the evening, right in your margin here, the word here in Hebrew is ereb. E-R-I-B. And the morning, that's the Hebrew word, bokir, or bokor. B-O-Q-U-E-R, bokir. There was your first day. Have you ever wondered why the Jews reckon their beginning of the day, not at midnight, like what we do? They look at sunset, more specifically, and they can spot the first two stars. Why do they do that? It makes things very confusing. Well, here's what they get it. That the night, the evening, and the morning were the first day. That's why Jews reckon their new day at sunset. Verse 5. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And so evening, Ereb, and the morning, Boker, were the first day. And this is very important. Literal solar day or day age? Nope. Write in your margin, Exodus chapter 20, verses 8 through 11. Let me read it to you. Exodus 20, verse 8. Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. 6 days shalt thou labor and do all your work. But in six days, literal solar 24-hour periods, Lord made the heaven and the earth, the sea, and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day. Wherefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath and hallowed it. You guys, was creation 6 ages, epochs of jillions of years? No. God's own word says it was a day. 6 days. How can there be an evening and a morning without the sun? The sun's not going to show up until day 4. Hey, good question. Both words are not used on day 7, by the way, evening and morning, Ereb and Boker. Ereb actually means in Hebrew, obscuration, we would say mixture, foggy. Darkness doesn't also deny the ability to discern forms, shapes, identities, hence the word twilight. That's in Proverbs 7, verse 9. Boker means becoming discernible, distinguishable, visible. We got it, see, we got it. At nighttime, stuff is dark. In the morning, stuff gets lighter. We can see stuff and not trip over things. A perception of order, rolling back of obscurity. Are you seeing it? Why did God call that a day? Darkness into light. Where our day typically doesn't begin until the sun wakes us up, as a rule. Except if you have to go to work very early. So we start in the daylight and we move to darkness. Do you see what God is doing by the evening and the morning were the first day? Because it is a model of what God does for us. What do you mean? Step by step, day by day, should be a reminder to go from Ereb to Boker. Every day, if we will let him, he will move us from obscuration, muddy, hazy, to discernible, distinguishable, visible truth. It's a model. God says, if you don't look to me, every one of your days begins in darkness. But if you hold on to my word, you will move from darkness and fogginess to the fullness of light. Amen!